Hello, this is just a quick note from Philip. This episode was put together in 2025 and scheduled in advance, so as a lot of these things are. And just in the last week, we heard the sad news that Dr. Berute Galdicus has passed away. It's still quite hard to believe. She was a force of nature, and it feels odd that she's no longer here. It's the end of an era. For 55 years, she worked tirelessly to protect forests and those that lived there, including orangutans and bears. She impacted so many people, myself included, and I'm forever grateful for the opportunity she gave me and memories that I treasure, and friendship. You wouldn't be listening to this whole series of episodes on sun bears and Indonesia without her. Her legacy lives on through Orangutan Foundation International and those she inspired. My thoughts are with her family and the team there. I like to think she's now reunited with her husband Pak Bohap and one of her best orangutan friends Siswi. This episode is dedicated to her. Thank you. Hello, we've come to the last episode of our Indonesian Odyssey, and we will be returning to North America in the next episode. So this is a recording of a chat that I had with my dear friend Kobe Steele last year, founder of OFI Australia. We talked about all sorts of things from her early life in showbiz to how she found her way to being an advocate for Bornean wildlife. I must warn listeners, we do discuss the loss of a child, and there are a couple of references to suicide. If this does affect you, please contact local support lines in your country. As our conversation progressed, we do find that, as we have heard from visitors and volunteers at the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, nature and time in nature is a powerful healer. We also, of course, have to talk about bears, and we talk about some of the bears in Borneo that OFI Australia has helped, including a world-first operation on a sun bear. I have certainly never heard of its like elsewhere, but I'm willing to be corrected. So thank you, and I look forward to speaking to you again very soon. There is a place in the remote northwoods of Minnesota, North America. It's located near the town of Orr, population approximately 300. Outside of this town is an area where normal rules are put to one side. It's a place where humans and wildlife meet. It's a special place, wholly unique and not without its controversies. This is the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, run by the American Bear Association, ABA for short. The ABA is dedicated to promoting a better understanding of black bears and all wildlife through education, observation, and experience. I'm your host, Philip Stubley, and welcome to the Bear Den. Lovely. Okay. So, I'll just do my little bit at the start. We're welcoming Kobe Steele into the Bear Den, and that is not the major Japanese steel manufacturer, but it's a lady who is a powerhouse all of her own. She's a ray of sunshine, and whenever she asks me to help with something, I just can't say no. She's the founder and president of Orangutan Foundation International Australia, OFIA, here on in. And Kobe, you are also the recipient of the Medal of the Order of Australia in the 2021 Queen's Birthday Honours List for services to conservation and the environment. I mean, as an intro, that's hard to beat.
Yes, can you believe that? I can't believe it myself.
Oh, I can. Would you like to tell us where you're speaking to us from?
Oh, hello. Hello, Philip. I am speaking to you from my office in the Gold Coast in Australia. So I'm just about 5 minutes away from surface paradise, and it's winter here, so it's a bit freezing by our standards, by our Queensland standards.
I was about to say, what do you mean freezing? It's still like, you know, freezing tropical
like
weather to us.
18 or 20 degrees.
Oh, wow. if only.
But yes, I'm sitting in my office and so happy to be talking to you.
Oh, no, I'm ecstatic as well. I was going to say, so like the list of accolades can go on because I've been doing a little bit of research, all right? Well, according to what I've been reading, like, you were the first woman to host an Australian national rock music show at the age of 19.
Yes, actually at the age of 18.
18, yes, all right. It was incorrect then. I'm just fascinated. So like I thought before we kind of get to the conservation part of your career, I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about where you came from and how that kind of came about.
Sure. Well, in my past life, a few past lives ago, I worked in the music business for probably for about 12 years all up. And so when I left school, all I wanted to do was be in the music business. You know, I didn't really know what that meant. It just sounded good. I was crazy, crazy about music, and especially all that English stuff from the 70s. And so my first job when I left school, I worked in the record library of a radio station in Perth. I went to school in Sydney, but then I went to Perth for a holiday and ended up getting a job there. And so I did that just for a few months. And to me, to actually get to sit in a room all day and listen to records and get them ready for the DJs, which was my job, was just fantastic. But then I moved back to Sydney, and so I got a job working as a PR girl for Festival Records, which was a record company here in Australia, who actually Rupert Murdoch bought a few years ago, but you know, that was way before he was involved. But so it was an Australian record company, and so I did PR and got to do publicity for, you know, quite a few of the big Australian bands at the time. And then of course the international acts would tour Australia, so I'd get to do a bit of that. So, you know, at that stage I was 17, and I mean, it doesn't get more exciting than a 17-year-old that's crazy about music getting to do that all day, every day. So that was fabulous. And as part of my job doing PR for record companies, one of the things I had to do was take new records into radio stations. And in those days, music television was almost non-existent, but there was two or three music shows that would show an occasional film clip. But there was a new show starting on Channel 10 in Sydney, and it was actually a national show. And so, of course, I got all my film clips together for my acts and trotted in to see the new producer. The show hadn't started yet. I really didn't know much about it, but I was just plugging to try and get my film clips on. And so I met with the producer, and I didn't really understand why, but the head of the production company, like the big head honcho, also decided to sit in on the meeting, which I thought was kind of a bit odd. But, you know, I was a kid, right? So I was always nervous, and you know, I didn't know how it worked. So anyway, I sat there and I talked about all my bands and the acts and the videos that I'd like them to play. And they kept asking me a lot of questions, and I don't mind a chat, so I was happy to answer. But they kept asking me about bands that I wasn't representing, which I thought was, you know, unusual. But so I just kept answering, and I'd answer any question they asked me. And then, you know, it turned out to be, you know, an hour or two. And normally those things are 10, 15 minutes. But at the end of it all, the big boss said to me, "Okay, you've got the job." And I went, "Well, what the?" I had no idea what he was talking about, because I was there to plug my bands and to get videos on this new television show. But they had thought they were interviewing me to be the host of the show. And so
did you just walk, you walked in and like at the right time, I guess, or?
I guess. And I mean, they knew what I did, but they decided to check me out for this, for this new show. So it was at that very first show I did was Saturday mornings, 3-hour show, Saturday mornings, like 9 to midday. And it was national. It was all around Australia. And I co-hosted with somebody else. And I did that for about 6 months. And then from there, Channel 10 were happy with me, mm-hmm. I guess. And so they offered me my own show. And so that was when I became the first female to host their own music television show in Australia. And I think I just turned 18. And it was quite amazing. It was the name of the show, when you say it now, is quite embarrassing. But it was called Right On.
Right On.
Right On. So I did that, I think, for 2.5 years. And so, yeah, I got to, it was half an hour every day, Monday to Friday, straight after school. I was, you know, aimed at the school kids. And so, you know, 4:30 every afternoon. And so what was lovely is there was no other music show, you know, during the week after school. So kids had come home from school and turn my show on. And
you were the tastemaker. You shaped a generation.
I guess at that time I kind of was. And so I played film clips, interviewed bands, did music specials. So pretty amazing when you look back for an 18-year-old. But at the time, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But and I never took it for granted. But I think I had imposter syndrome the whole time I was doing it, because I couldn't believe it. But it kind of started me on my way, and it was loads of fun. But I used to record all of the shows on a Thursday night. So you do the five shows, half hour shows, back to back to back, pre-recorded on a Thursday night. So during the week, I would work in the office on production of the show, but really there wasn't enough for me to do. So I decided to go out and get a job. So I got a job again. I can't believe they gave it to me, but they did. I got a job with just the most wonderful man called David Douglas, who's no longer with us. But at that time, he was one of the main publicists in Australia for international tours, for music international tours. And so he gave me a full-time job as a publicist, working with the most extraordinary bands touring Australia. And I mean, there was three of us that worked in the office. So he did kind of the middle of the road stuff. And then Pammy, who is still a dear friend, did like the classical and the jazz. And so I got to do all the rock stuff. And so it was during the time of it was, you know, I guess while I was doing the TV show was like the punk era with Sex Pistols, et cetera, but and into new wave. But by the time I was doing this, it was a lot of the new wave acts, so many, many British acts. But yeah, I got to tour with some extraordinary people. I toured with Bob Marley, which is like, you know, gives me a bit of cred.
Yeah,
These days,
definitely.
people think I'm like, you know, a bit boring if I drop Bob Marley into the
I was there.
conversation.
Was there a fairly chilled out tour?
Well, you know what? Have we got time? I'll tell you a Bob Marley story if you
Oh,
want.
tell me.
But it wasn't so chilled out because Bob Marley, when he came, I mean, he was pretty chilled out. Yes,
Yeah, I
absolutely.
figured he might be.
But he brought with him 56 people on the road, which is, you know, a lot. It was a lot then, and it's a lot now. I'm not talking about you know, the lighting people and the audio people. I'm just talking about his band and the people that looked after him. They brought their wives and they brought their kids. So in those days, when you came to Australia, you would come through customs. And then you would then, you know, the big star, the big act would be go through customs first, and then he would go to like a press conference room at the airport, because it was the old days where, you know, the journalists would you know, throw a microphone in their face when they'd been off the plane for 2.5 minutes and say, "How are you loving Australia?" So that was the deal. But of course, with Bob Marley, it was a little bit different. One, because he had so many people on the road with him, but also because, you know, obvious reasons, we were so worried that he'd be carrying something on him, and that, you know, he wouldn't even make it to the press conference. So in those days, and I'm not sure how that happened, but believe me, it's not like this anymore. But we did a deal, we meaning the promoter, not me, did a deal with customs where if we absolutely promised faithfully that Bob would carry nothing on him, you know, I'm talking weed, of course, that they could do a quick search of him, and then they could search till the cows come home, the other 56 people that were on the tour. So that happened. Bob got through, and the promoter, Kevin Jacobson, took Bob through to the press conference, and I stayed with a couple of other people. And then the customs people, the agents here in Australia, literally searched head to toe, body search, every case, every crook, and every little section of every suitcase, every bag. Honestly, it took, I don't know, it felt like 2 hours, and they just search, 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 search. And the whole time we were all like on a razor's edge, expecting someone to get busted any minute. So finally, the very last person got through, and you know, not one person was carrying any dope on them. We couldn't believe it. 56 people, all Rastafarians. And so this was into Sydney Airport, and their very first concerts were to be Melbourne. So out the front of Sydney International Airport, we had two great big buses, like coaches, ready to put all of the band onto the coaches and then drive them around to the domestic airport to fly them to Melbourne, sorry. So we did that. You know, I would have had my cohort on the other bus. So everyone got onto the bus, and I can still picture it now. You know, all these big Rasta guys and their wives and kids all getting onto the bus. They were all carrying their musical instruments. And you know, I said to the driver, "Okay, we're ready to go." And the doors closed. And literally before the doors had closed, they had their music instruments out. They were playing, they were singing, which was very cool. But the whole of the bus started filling up with dope smoke, right? And they'd all just been searched. So I'm telling you, before they left Sydney Airport, they were all stoned. But I couldn't work out how, so I turned around and they were pulling all their joints out of their dreadies.
Oh, well, there you go.
And of course, in those days, there were no dogs. And of course, the customs guys searched them from head to toe, but they didn't check their hair.
They
So
didn't
there you
smell anything, or yeah.
obviously not. So yeah, that will stay with me till the day I die. It was a very, very funny thing. So yeah, it was really fun touring with Bob Marley and so many other people, you know. I was 18, 19, 20 years old when I was doing that, and I had a lot of fun. And at that time,
Living the groupie dream almost.
well, you know what? I was married.
Oh.
Actually, no, I got married when I was 20, but I was living with my then boyfriend, probably from the age of 19, and he was also a musician.
I was about to say, is this Mark Evans,
Yes,
the sort
it is.
of bass? Well, he was bass player for AC/DC for a while, right? I don't know
Yes,
how long.
yes. He was bass player with AC/DC until while they were in London and Europe, but before they made it in America. So he was in AC/DC during the Bon Scott days, and then Bon obviously died, obviously, and Mark had left just prior to that, the album before that, and then of course Brian
And
Johnson.
of course, Brian Johnson from Newcastle, UK.
That's
That's
right.
the
That's
connection
right.
there,
And you know what? I've only met him once, but everybody I know that knows him says he's just the loveliest, loveliest guy. So of course he's from Newcastle. So
They're all great from here.
yeah. So there, that's a little bit about my music days, but I had a lot of fun. And then from that, I went into radio in Sydney, and I worked in radio for quite a long time. I produced a breakfast program. I used to get to come to London to Capital Radio
Oh, wow.
and broadcast back to Australia. But yeah, I had so much fun, and I was so young, and I
That's so
still can't
cool.
believe they
Still
allowed me to
young.
do all
I
that.
bet. And I was going to say, I mean, are you still a keen concert goer? Been
Very
seeing your
much so.
shows? Yeah. What was the last show you went to see?
Oh my goodness, why are you asking me that? Because now I'm having a brain drain moment and I can't remember. It wasn't Ed Sheeran. I can't remember. Oh, you know what? I can't remember who it was. Oh, I was just at Blues Fest. I was just at Blues Fest. And so that was Crowded House at Blues Fest. And Chaka Khan. And with the Orangutan Foundation International, I have a charity market stall at Blues Fest every year. And
Oh,
I don't know
nice.
if you, do you know what Blues Fest is?
Not really off the top of my head, no.
Yeah, no,
I
that's
can
right.
imagine. I can imagine what it is,
I
but
didn't expect you to. I just realised I was talking about it like you knew what it was. Blues Fest is the biggest music festival in Australia, and it's been going, oh my goodness, forever and ever and ever. And it's a 5-day festival and amazing international acts and also some great Australian ones. So that was
oh,
the last
cool.
show.
That's great. But oh, that's so cool. That's such a I'm very fascinated. I probably could talk to you all day just asking you questions about who you met and like where you've been and whatnot with that. I suppose we should move on slightly to get closer to what the podcast's actually about. But the way that Orangutan Foundation International Australia was founded was obviously quite tragic circumstances, really, that realigned your life.
Yes.
And you had your daughter Kristen, and I'd love to hear some stories about her, some happy
Oh,
memories.
yeah. Kristen was my only child. I was a single mum, and Mark and I'd broken up, but Mark was her father. So I raised her by myself, and I think we brought each other up, right? Because I was quite young when I had her, and so she was my absolute best friend. She was, you know, she was my everything. She was divine. Every mother says that. We're all totally biased, but Kristen was fantastic. And I just, you know what? I hope she knew how fantastic she was. So she finished university, and then she went off traveling. Most Australian kids, you know, when they finish uni, go off and see the world, and Kristen was no different. So she went to Japan for a while, and then off to the States, and then she ended up in London, and she met her future husband in London. He was at the London Film and Television School. He was a Norwegian guy called Chris, who I still am very much in touch with. So after they'd been in London for the amount of time she was allowed to be on her visa, they moved to Amsterdam, and they're about to get married, and Kristen was 25, and I just remember, you know, what it was like at 25 to be in love, right? She was so in love. She was so happy. And, you know, I'd never seen her that happy. So she was, yeah, she was oozing with joy. She was working at Hard Rock Cafe, in Amsterdam. And she was on her way to work on a bicycle, as you are in Amsterdam. And she was in a line at a red light at a main intersection in Amsterdam. And she was one block from work, like she could actually see work from where she was. And this crazy, angry, wasn't having a good day. Driver in a very large concrete truck was speeding, and he came around a corner and he was going really, really fast. He came to a really dramatic stop at the red light, and he, in doing so, he kind of went into the bike lane. So he was kind of monstering, if you like. Mm-hmm. You know, the truck was monstering the bike riders. They were all stopped. It was a red light. So we're in Amsterdam. When the red light goes, the bike riders have right of way, so they go first, and then a second light goes for the cars and the trucks. Unfortunately, because he was having a stressy day, when the first light went for the bikes, he actually went forward and turned right against what he was supposed to do. And Kristen was the first person in the line. Oh. And so when he turned, he took her with him, and he crushed her, and so there's no words. I mean, there is no words that can explain it, except that at that time I got that phone call that absolutely nobody wants to get, and I just pray that that no one listening ever gets it. But my world absolutely stopped, and I'm normally fairly outgoing, fairly confident, gregarious, but I became absolutely, you know, all I did was cry. I just cried. I think I cried for 3 years. I didn't stop, and I became agoraphobic. I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything. I honestly believed that my purpose in life was to be Kristen's mum, which at that time it was. And so when she was killed, I felt I had absolutely no purpose and no reason to be here anymore. And so I did try to commit suicide twice, and thank goodness I was unsuccessful, and I'm sure Kristen held my hand and pulled me back. But yeah, I just had no reason to be here, and well, I thought I didn't. And orangutans weren't part of my life then. My life just stopped, and I just stayed home. And then I had a very dear friend who lived in Perth at that time. His name is Stephen Van Mill, Dr. Stephen Van Mill, and he is very, very involved with Australian wildlife, and he started the Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital. And he came over to visit me, and he hadn't seen me since Kristen had been killed, and it was probably about 18 months or close to 2 years after it had happened. And we went out for dinner, and he could see just how messed up I was. And you know, one of the things that I found, and I'm sure everyone that's lost a child finds, is that people don't know what to say. They don't know how to talk to you when you've lost a child. It's bad enough if you've lost a parent or a grandparent or a friend, but when it's your child, people just want to run screaming from the room. They don't know what to say. And I guess I would have been the same before. But as a result, when people talked to me, I was so grateful that they stayed and talked to me rather than avoiding me. Yeah. That regardless of what they said, people said really weird things because they were nervous and because they were awkward and uncomfortable. So what I learned is that no matter what weird things people said, that I would just answer them and be grateful and be happy. And so I agreed with everything they said. So Stephen came over and he had dinner with me. And as I say, orangutans were not part of my life, other than Kristen and I used to watch orangutan documentaries and ooh and ah and think they were just divine. But Stephen said to me, Kobe, he had just come back from making a documentary about Dr. Birute Galbakas, who you and I both know very closely. And so he'd been in Borneo. And he said, Kobe, I'm going to take you to the orangutans and they're going to heal you. And that was probably the weirdest thing that anybody had said to me today, right? One, that orangutans weren't part of my life. And also the thought that anything could ever heal me was, to me at that time, ridiculous. And so so as I did in those days, I just agreed. I just agreed with everything because that was easier. So I said, Stephen, that would be fantastic. I'd love to go, knowing that when we finished dinner, I'd go home and I'd never leave the house again. And so Stephen, God love him, I'll be forever grateful, was like a dog with a bone. And so he didn't let it go. And he would ring me and say, okay, I'm booking for us to go, blah, 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 blah. And every time I'd come up with some pathetic excuse for why I couldn't go. But in the end, I just gave in because, you know, he just wasn't taking no for an answer. And I figured I just turned 50. And so I thought it was kind of a nice, like, 50th birthday present to myself. And I also thought that maybe going into the Bornean rainforest, the jungle, would be good for my soul. And I really have always believed and believe even more now that nature is the most healing thing there is. Being around animals is the only thing greater for healing to me than standing in a beautiful rainforest. And so I figured it might be good for me. So off I went to Borneo, never been there before, on an eco tour, similar to ones that I now take. And, oh, Philip, you already know because you've spent so much time there, but it was just extraordinary. So we spent the first few days in the jungle, in the rainforest, seeing wild orangutans at the feeding stations run by OFI. And honestly, it was gobsmacked. I mean, I was just in awe. They were just beautiful. But at the same time, my heart had died when Kristen died. And I hadn't felt a moment of happiness since then. I know I sound like I'm playing the violin, but I really, my heart just didn't feel. And so I was looking at these gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful orangutans, and I couldn't have been more excited to see them, but still my heart was dead. And so, but yeah, the trip was amazing. But then the last 2 days, on our eco tour, because Stephen had been and done a documentary with Dr. Galdakas, he got permission to take me into the Orangutan Foundation International Care Center. And that is the most incredible place. Dr. Galdakas and the OFI team, I mean, one of their greatest missions is to rescue orphaned, injured, and displaced orangutans. These orangutans then go to the care center and they start a very long rehabilitation journey back to the wild. I mean, it can take, you know, 10, 12, 14 years. But as the orangutans go through this rehabilitation journey, it's basically in age groups. I'm telling you what you already know.
No, it's good. It's good context. It means I don't have to give it.
So you know, they come in as babies, so they'll start in the nursery, and then as their skills develop, they go into different age groups. So I got to go to the care center, which was, oh my God, incredible. On the first day I was there, I got to go to what was called Pondok Chimpaduk, and at that time, that was where the infants were. It was before Camp Danielle, so it was where the infants went to forest school at that time. And in this playground was, you know, an amazing set of like tires and swings and platforms. And then close off to the side was forest and trees. But I was there that day with little 3, 4, and 5-year-old orangutans. Honestly, you know, they are like kids on red cordial, right? And they're all just crazy and running around. And I could not believe my eyes. It was just, for me, it was like being in heaven. And to actually be there, I was pinching myself. But off in the corner was a little orangutan. He was probably 3 or 4 years old, and he was staying away from the rest of the orangutans and just watching. He was very subdued. He had basically no hair. Not completely bald, but as bald as you get. Now I know, I didn't know then, but now I know that was because his mother had recently been killed, and he had severe malnutrition and severe depression. And when orangutans have, you know, depression and malnutrition, they lose their hair. So he was pretty well bald as a badger, and he wasn't climbing trees and he wasn't interacting. And the carers told me at that time that they thought that they weren't sure whether he was going to learn to climb a tree. And honestly, his beautiful little face, he was a little tiny guy, came up just above my knee, and my maternal instinct just screamed. I just wanted to go over and hug him. And what I know now that I didn't know then is that Faisal was standing off in the corner. And I believe, and I'm sure you do too, I believe that when orangutans look into your eyes, yes, they see you, they see your physical being, but I really believe they see into your heart. And I think that they read you. They're incredibly intuitive. They have empathy. They're compassionate. I think they're just incredible. So what I know now is that Faisal was sitting over in the corner looking at me going, oh, look at poor, sad, sorry woman. Look at her. She needs some help. And so it sounds crazy, but this really happened and I've got photographs of it. So I kind of walked towards it. Sounds like a love
proof.
Story.
You've got proof. Sorry.
I walked closer to Faisal and he came up to me, gorgeous little thing, and he climbed up my body and he put his little face right in my face, eyes to eyes, and he stared into my eyes. And Philip, I swear this happened. I hadn't felt happiness since Christian had died. And little Faisal with his face and the love that I felt from him, I just got lightning bolts of happiness. They just shot through me. It was physical. And that little boy, that little Faisal, who is now a great big cheek patter, but at that time he was 3 or 4, he gave me back my happiness. And it was just, honestly, I can't describe it. It was incredible. So then I got to spend 2 days at the care center with Faisal and another little young orangutan called Krista. She was 3 years old. And so they took me through the swamps and up the trees and around the playground. And I just had the most extraordinary 2 days. And I was absolutely back. Like, I was me again. I felt happiness. I felt joy. I was excited. I didn't have to fake smile. You know, I was back. I couldn't believe what these gorgeous little things did. So then I had to leave. I know I cried a lot when I left and I didn't know what to do when I came home because, you know, those guys just helped me so much. I'd been in grief counseling every week for like a few years, 2-3 years. And so I canceled my grief counseling. I was completely like so much better and started socializing again. And I just wanted to do something to thank them, to help them, to help OFI and thank OFI for giving me that experience, but mainly just to help the orangutans that were there. Because, you know, Orangutan Foundation is a tiny little charity that punches way above its weight, in my opinion, and they do it on a shoestring. There's so little money. And so I just wanted to help. So I researched the eco tour that I'd just been on, and I found out that everybody was making money except the orangutans, you know, the tour operators and the eco tour guides, who I don't begrudge at all making money, but just the buses and the planes, everyone was making money, but not the orangutans. And OFI was getting very, very, very little in financial support from eco tours. So I did my research and I started doing eco tours to Borneo. And that's how I started raising money for OFI. And that was before I started OFI Australia, but that I started doing eco tours and just sending all the profits to OFI. And then after about 2 years, I'd never met Dr. Gaudacass. I didn't know her at all. But about 2 years in, no, more than 2 years. It was end of 2012. So 4 years in, I actually got to meet her. And that's when I was a groupie. I was so excited because, of course, by then I knew all about her and knew what an amazing, amazing human being she was. And so she met me and we talked and she asked me would I please come with her to visit a forest called Roakuna Village Forest. And she explained to me along the way that the village elders had come to see her and it was a huge, huge piece of land. And they'd come to see her and they'd offered to sell it to her, but she only had a finite amount of time to raise the money. And it was a lot of money. I think it was about $750,000. It was a really, really lot of money.
Is that Australian dollars or US?
I think that was Australian dollars. I think right. It was Australian. And she said that she had exhausted all of her fundraising ability and they were still $250,000 short. And if she didn't have the money by, let's say, December, I think it was December, and this was September now we were talking, that they were going to sell to the palm oil plantations and then it would be deforested and there were many wild orangutans living in the village forest and it was going to be a disaster. So I heard myself say, still makes me laugh that I said this, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I still don't think I do. But I said to her, look, don't worry, I'll go back to Australia and I'll form Orangutan Foundation International Australia and I'll raise the money for you. And so I came back and I founded OFI Australia. There's lots of bureaucracy involved in starting a charity, so it took me a while. But God only knows how. And I totally believe my daughter Kristen held my hand because I couldn't have done it otherwise. There was angels in the universe helping me. And I raised the $250,000. And so I sent it to her. And there you go. I'll be quiet now. I've talked for so long. But that's how I started OFI Australia. And that's how I got involved with orangutans.
No, that's amazing. I mean, it's like you say, it shows the restorative healing power of nature, doesn't it? Because obviously you went through something no one should have to go through. I'm just like, it's amazing. I mean, you could keep talking. Don't worry. I'm wrapped. I'm a groupie right now. Speaking of as well, there's a new young female orangutan at the care centre. And what's her name?
Her name is Kristen Steele.
Yeah.
I might not have mentioned, oh, maybe I did earlier, but my daughter's name is Kristen and my surname is Steele. So, you know, I actually started OFI Australia officially in 2013. So it's 12 years now. And I am beyond excited that there's this gorgeous little one-year-old called Kristen Steele, and my daughter would be beside herself with joy. And what I think is funny is Dr. Gaudacass is insisting that this little orangutan be called Kristen Steele, not just Kristen. Mm. So it feels a little bit silly when I say her whole name. But, yeah, I couldn't be happier.
No, that's great.
And just while I'm at it, little plug, she's joining our foster program soon. So I hope that anyone and everyone listening to this will please foster her in a month or two.
When I was writing the foster update, I was going to say, like, because I had to, obviously I was putting Kristen Steele all the time. It just felt like really formal doing it. But I was like, no, it's fine. It's fine. Obviously you've talked about the ego tours now. So I just kind of wanted to ask how, it's two a year you normally do, right?
Yes.
And so what
yes.
do they normally involve? You're booked up for like 2026 already, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm booked out till the end of next year. It's crazy. Look, they're really, really special. And the reason they're special is because, as you would know, the OFI Care Centre is closed to the general public. And, you know, if you want to stand at that security gate with, you know, a check for $30,000 in your hand, they will not let you in. It's a no-go. There is a lot of vaccinations that you have to have, but realistically, nobody gets to go in and visit the care centre. The first part of our eco tour, we spend in Tandron Pudding National Park, which is fantastic. We stay at Rimba Lodge, which is a fantastic little eco lodge, the only place with accommodation in the forest. Most people stay on Clotocks, which are the wooden boats that go clip top, clip top, clip top. And but we stay in this little lodge that is just fantastic. And so we spend 3 days and we go to the various OFI feeding stations, and people get to know and see orangutans in the wild. Not only wild-born orangutans, but many of the ex-captives that OFI have rehabilitated. So you see the ex-captives, but you also see their children and their grandchildren. And just as an aside, when I started OFI Australia, I believe the headcount in the national park was around, at that time, 5,000 orangutans. But, you know, now there are over 6,000 orangutans in Tandron Pudding National Park. So it's the only place in the world where orangutan populations are increasing. So you really see heaps of orangutans on the eco tour, wild orangutans and you know, free orangutans, as they should be. But then in the last 2 days, we get to go and spend time in the care centre, and I'm able to take my guests behind the scenes. They get to see all the various stages of rehabilitation, the absolutely incredible work that OFI does, and, you know, they go to visit the ha-has for the orangutans that are in their last stages of rehabilitation. They get to see the herbarium. They get to see everything, and so it's really, really special. And the people I take don't actually know what they're going to see or experience when they come with me, because I tell them nothing. Mm-hmm. And so to watch the joy in their faces when they arrive and actually go out with orangutans to forest school and you know, all the things that they get to experience, seeing the nursery kids playing and swinging in the playground, learning to climb trees, it's just amazing anyway. So I, for some reason, have the privilege of being the only person in the world that can take people in to the care centre in an eco tour situation. And so I've got this big waiting list, and people can't wait for me to announce them, so they book out really fast.
It's not just people from Australia, right? You get people from
anyone
all over. Yeah.
My one in April, I think almost half of them are from the UK.
Oh, well, there you go. Word spreads. Since this is a bear-related podcast, apart from having a lovely chat, I thought I'd get you on to talk about some of the bears that OFI Australia specifically have helped, and there's two in particular that come to mind. I have a feeling, right, I first met you during one of your eco tours, and it was when you were at the care centre, and I think I was doing something with this male sun bear called Buddy. You sort of wandered over and said hello, and then from there, I started just badgering you because we did mention the foster program just before, and I convinced you somehow to add Buddy to your foster program to help.
Oh, you could raise convince me of anything.
Don't know. Well, to help raise some funds to build him an enclosure, because I thought, well,
yes.
Buddy was a sun bear that came to us from Jakarta. I think he was rescued from the wildlife trade, and unfortunately, he'd been mutilated. He'd had his claws forcibly removed. You know, they don't come back, and they are an integral part of a sun bear's kind of, you know, arsenal when they're in the forest. He'd been in Jakarta, and then was brought to Borneo in 2018. And then we looked after him, and he sort of grew into himself. I remember during his first week, you could tell he was really deprived, and he was very hesitant. And in his transport cage, he'd been rubbing his nose on the bars, so his nose was all swollen when he first got there.
But
he was like so full of energy. He was just like hopping along. He was like this frenzied sort of rabbit.
He was so cute, yeah.
I know, and he'd twirl around, he'd stand up on his hind legs and wrestle with... Editor's note. I just thought I'd drop in a little bit more info about Buddy here, as there were one or two fun things that occurred to me after mine and Kobe's chat. Following Buddy's arrival, we put him into a temporary enclosure, and he was bursting with energy. This little bear ran around investigating his new surroundings, and he seemed to bear no grudges towards people, and allowed us to begin to get to know him. And during his first week at the care centre, we took Buddy to the forest, something which he had so far been deprived. I do remember when the door to his enclosure was opened. After a little hesitancy, Buddy slowly emerged from the enclosure. With his nose cocked to the ground, Buddy seemingly followed a variety of new smells and sensations with great concentration. Next, it was time to practice climbing. Buddy suddenly shot up onto the top of his enclosure's roof. Enjoying the view at this newfound height, Buddy showed no intention of moving whatsoever, so it took about an hour and a half before he was persuaded to climb back down. Normally bears use claws for climbing, but Buddy devised his own method. He used his paws to loop into the sides of his enclosure and pulled himself up. He also employed this technique in the forest. If there are a group of trees clumped together, he'd confidently hook his paws around them and pull himself up, seemingly with little trouble. Nothing seemed to dampen Buddy's spirits. He bounded over whenever anyone approached, ready to engage. Life always seemed to be about one thing to him: running around as fast as possible and having as much fun as he can while doing it. And we did introduce him. We took him out for some walks with a couple of the other cubs, because he was probably about 2 years old when he came to us. So we did take him out with a couple of the other cubs so we could get to know them and play with them, which was very sweet. It's impossible not to fall for Buddy as his innocent wide eyes longingly gaze at you, his mouth hanging slightly open as he pants excitedly, urging you to play. After a bout of play, he normally liked to take a dip in his enclosure's tub. And then finally, he'd pass out in his tire hammock, exhausted. But he was always ready the next day to do it all over again. And despite his lack of claws, he did have an impressive set of teeth, which he put to good use. And he was able to use them to open coconuts. Bears really like coconuts, especially in a hot tropical climate. They're very refreshing. So first of all, he'd take out the green outer shell of these young coconuts. He'd then crack the harder inner shell. Like, mimicking his caregivers, Buddy picked up the coconut between his two front paws and dropped it on the ground repeatedly. Crack, 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 until the liquid gold inside flowed forth. He then prized the shell open and ate the flesh within. It was really cool, because after the first time, he got it down to just about a minute where he could open it. Buddy couldn't be released back to the wild. He was too habituated to humans, and without his claws, it would be hard to perform some simple tasks or to defend himself. Displaying a lust for life, he remains inquisitive, playful, and eager to learn. And that's Buddy. So, back to Kobe. Even though he made up for like the lack of claws with like quite big teeth, I think.
And he was strong. And, you know, he, you know this already, but you know, from an outside perspective, watching you and Buddy was So fantastic. He adored you. And he would bounce around, like you said, almost like a rabbit with joy, with you in the forest. I mean, to watch the both of you together was fantastic. My memories of Buddy are watching you and Buddy together because, I mean, by the time I met Buddy, he was definitely out of his shell and confident and happy. And I'll always remember you taking me out with him one day. And luckily I had gum boots on because we were going to go, in the muddy bit. And Buddy being absolutely exuberant and not trying to hurt me at all, but wrapped his arms and legs around
I
my
can
leg and
imagine
my
that.
gum boot, and sunk his teeth into my gum boot. And so, I probably smiled all the way through it, but I think inside I was quite nervous. But you rescued me anyway, and then I just watched you guys. I just watched you guys,
I
and he
know.
was just gorgeous. And knowing that he would never be released back into the wild. Then, like you say, like he needed help.
Well, it's funny because that's the thing with bears as well. You build a relationship and a bond with them, you play with them, and then of course when they meet other bears, you introduce them to the other bears, they can play together a lot rougher than they can with you, but they don't realize, my skin isn't like, elastic and flappy
Yes.
like a sun bear's, so they'll start biting and you're a bit like, I think we can't play together anymore. Was it someone, you'd had someone on your eco tour who'd seen him and like, looked at him and was just like, oh, I want to help him, so they actually
Yes.
donated
Yes.
a substantial amount of,
A
towards
lot of money.
the enclosure
Yeah.
that we ended up building for him and his
Yeah.
friends, where he is
A
now.
lovely lady called Laurel Clark, who's come quite often with me on eco tours. She fell in love with the sun bears and it was through Buddy. And yeah, so I did an appeal for Buddy and she donated, a lot of money. And then I was able to set it up and then you were able to help him.
Well, also we built that enclosure and it houses, well, it can house five sun bears, and there's one other sun bear in there, a female called Hitam, which means black in Indonesian. I mean, very appropriate and very imaginative, but she's got a face which is like a mask of gold. I always would say, like, she's got a very lovely face. Again, clearly grateful because OFI Australia helped her, but even in more immeasurably, I think. Forgive me, I'm going to give a little context now, and then I'm going to ask
Please.
you to carry on. Because she came in like this tiny thing. She was an expat. Unlike Buddy, she did have her claws, but her canines have been cut out. I guess people do this because it just makes them easier to handle as pets or whatever. So Hitam had came to us, and she was a tiny little thing, and we hadn't introduced her to any of the other bears yet, so she was by herself. And I had noticed that she was having this difficulty passing stool. She was really straining, burying her head on the platform in a lot of discomfort. And I had mentioned it. And then we'd sort of looked and we're like, well, we'll keep an eye. It kept happening. And then so it got to a point where she's rolling around the floor, sort of panting, straining. So,
It's an agony,
yeah. So we took her for an X-ray and we quickly confirmed her bones were malformed. She clearly had been like starved of nutrition when she was younger anyway, because she was very small for, and I think she was older than she looked. We saw that her like pelvic canal was only like 1 centimeter wide. A healthy sun bear is like 4 centimeters wide. And because of this, she had this large intestine, which narrowed right down near the, sorry for the sort of biological details, but down near the rectum. So it made it difficult for her to pass feces. And then,
Okay.
yeah. And then, so it became what was becoming a mega colon, which is something I found out about. And like I say, this was directly a result of her being taken from the wild by humans. Let's say her quote unquote owner told the staff when she was brought in that she was brought up on like a diet of rice and milk, which is totally inappropriate. And so she had very stunted growth. And so this was like a chronic condition basically that needed to be managed on a daily basis. We were like, right, we'll give her watery, digestible food, stuff like papaya. Obviously, she was being kept by herself. And for the best part of a year, I think I was giving her basically giving her medicine like laxatives, lactulose constipen is the specific one I think I was giving her just to help, ease that passage. So this was like 3 times a day to start with until she was feeling a bit better. Then we reduce the dose, but at first it just seemed like that's what we're gonna have to do just for the rest of our life, right? Keep her stable, and we just thought that was the best thing. And then we did a further
She's
ex
tiny. She was so small for her age.
yeah like because the problem is we never know when we get these bears in, you don't know the history. So she looked like a cub. She was like the size of a cub, but
Oh,
she was
yeah.
clearly, I think, at least sub-adult, maybe 5, 6, 7. Again, it's all ballpark. You're kind of going off the information you've got. After about a year, we did another X-ray, but unfortunately, we saw the large intestine had grown, and this was turning into a bit of an issue. And we were just like, "What can we do here?" And then I can't remember precisely who it was, but we spoke to you essentially, and then you kind of said, "Oh, I'll see what I can do." And so essentially, this was like a world first. I don't think I've come across any other sun bear that's had this operation in the world. But so this life-changing surgery, which involved an international team, was just around the corner. And I suppose...
Five on the...
Yeah, and I thought maybe I could ask you to continue the story of what I think was dubbed Operation Sunbear Borneo.
Yes, it's exactly what we called it.
Yeah.
I still remember being there and you and Dr. Katutz speaking to me and saying this bear needs an operation, but, you know, it needed like mega specialists, right? It couldn't just be a normal operation, because exactly as you said, her colon and just that whole canal down to her rectum was just crazy thin, and it needed to be widened. And that was going to need a piece made, you know. And so I came back here and I actually, Stephen Van Mill, who took me to see the orangutans for the first time and is still a very dear friend, he's also a vet as well as a documentary maker, and he's quite well connected in the vet world. And so he actually, we talked and we decided to do an appeal, and I asked for his help to get a team together to actually look at Hitam's situation to see if anything could be done, because I, you know, as you know, nothing like this had ever been done before, and it wasn't going to be like a cheap thing. And so, but first of all, we had to see if it was possible. So you guys organized heaps of x-rays and sent them down to me, and I passed them on to Stephen. And then he contacted two people. He contacted Dr. Gordon Corfield, which doesn't mean anything to anyone outside Australia, but he's Australia's leading orthopaedic surgeon for animals, and he has a specialist centre here in the Gold Coast where I live. And of course, the majority of what he does is dogs and cats and domestic animals, but his knowledge is just beyond belief. And, you know, passing around the x-rays and showing as many people as we could, it would appear he was the only person that had the confidence that he could do something. So on top of that, we also, through Stephen, again, contacted Dr. Larry Vogelnest, who is the head vet, or was at that time, the head vet at Sydney's Taronga Park Zoo. And so he was operating every day on a gorilla one day, a zebra the next day, a giraffe the next day, a tarantula the next day, you know, just every kind of animal. And he is also probably the best wildlife anaesthetist in Australia. And what was ascertained quite early was that this operation, if it was possible to go ahead with Hitam, was going to take a long time. Like Hitam might be, you know, under anaesthetic for 7, 8, 9 hours. And I mean, no animal would normally live through that. So we needed an expert anaesthetist. So Larry and Gordon both put up the hand and agreed to come to Borneo and do this operation for free. We also needed a specialist vet nurse, and Stephen, who was also a vet, not a specialist, but a vet, also agreed to come because we needed a team. And sounds crazy for one little bear, but what was being done was extraordinary. And so, but before we could do anything, we had to have a piece made. And I'm not a medical person, so I don't know all the correct terms, but there was this amazing guy in Melbourne who, mainly for humans, but also for animals, made prosthetics and pieces where they were needed. So what he needed to do for Hitam was to make a metal piece, like a titanium steel kind of piece, so that when they went in and operated on Hitam, they could put a piece in to expand his poor little colon and rectal canal, so that he would be able to poo. And because if that hadn't been done, it would have then closed up again. So that was made. And then I just had to do this big appeal and raise as much money as possible, I think, to get all the people up there, to fly them up there, their accommodation, take buy all the equipment that was needed, and you know, pay for everything that was needed. I think it was about $30,000. So yeah, it happened, and we raised the $30,000, and the team came up, and the rest is history. They it was a 9-hour operation, as you know, and I remember us all just standing out there for hours and hours and hours watching from outside the operating theatre. It was just, you know, Gordon had his hands up in the air for like 9 hours, like can't be shaky, just amazing, amazing ability he had. So then back to you, because you actually were with Hitam after that. And yes, it was life-saving surgery, but it was also a big success. And then I went home and you stayed. So over to you as to what happened with...
Well, yeah, because that was the funniest part was because I know that we'd originally scheduled it for a certain date and then it had to get moved. But then, of course, the date it got moved to, I was actually away in America. For listeners to the pod, they'll know precisely where I was. I was at the Vinshuti Wildlife Sanctuary. So I actually missed the day of the operation, but I came back maybe a couple of days after it, and I did get to meet the team on their way out. So we did get the sort of...
They met you at the airport, didn't they?
I was like, yeah, I came to their hotel, I think. And then we caught up. I took some notes. It was quite nice just to meet people and discuss and hear about it all. And then the first couple of weeks post-op were quite intense because we're obviously watching for any sign of infection or anything. And we'd set up this small area for the recuperate in. And like I said, she had this like bald back quarter and you could tell it was probably a bit itchy. So we were concerned about her stitches, but her incisions closed up. No complications. And then she had to be again also on all sorts of different meds post-op, and some were easier to administer than others, and mixing in with honey to get her to take them, but quite bitter pills, some of them, I think. So constant changes in approach.
Was she in a really enclosed small space?
Yeah, so it was like, I mean, it was maybe like a meter by half a meter, it was small, but we'd also boarded it up because we were worried about the other bears, because it was in an area where when we took the other cubs out for forest school, they could walk up and potentially bother her. So we kind of had to cover that up. And yeah, I know that we changed approaches and mixing in with like watermelon, papaya, and sometimes it worked. Other times she'd sniff it and just push it to one side. She was just like a difficult patient sometimes, but we persevered.
How much melon can a bear bear?
Well, exactly. I mean, bears are individuals. And like as with Hitam, individual solutions needed.
Yes.
Her incisions healed up well. She couldn't put any weight on her back right leg for the first month. And then we did an x-ray 6 weeks later, which showed a significant improvement internally. So her large intestine looked more like it should. And I think her pelvic canal was measured at about 2.5 centimeters. So that's like a full 1.5 centimeters wider than it had been prior to the op. So it was excellent and joyous. And then she began using her back leg, walking all fours. And then she seemed very happy. I mean, she's still... We haven't really been able to integrate her with anyone, any of the other bears particularly. I think she's a bit of a, likes her own company. So that's fine. That's okay. And then long story short, she then ended up in the big enclosure separately to Buddy. And I mean, you saw them not too long ago.
Yeah, I saw them recently. Yeah. And now she's a big bear. She's now, honestly, she's grown so much because now she can eat normally and she's doing great. And she's so much bigger. She's, she's the size she should be now.
I'm just happy that she's happy as well, able to just live a comfortable, normal life. I mean, obviously not where she should be, but as good as it can be, right?
But because, as you said, all of this happened because of human greed, I call it, of people wanting to keep wildlife as pets. I mean, she should never have been in that situation. So it was our responsibility, I believe, ours meaning yours and mine and OFI's, to do anything we could for her, And luckily,
Yeah. No, that's great. I'm so glad I got you on to talk about that. What's OFI Australia fundraising for at the minute? Like, what are you working on now?
Right this minute, I mean, I fundraise all the time. I mean, I guess that's my MO with OFI Australia, because obviously I'm not in Borneo, but I need to raise as much money as I can so that they can do what they want to do. And it's by no means just me raising money, but I like to think that it helps. And I've just about hit $5 million now that I've raised for them. So that's fantastic.
$5 million Australian dollars. Sorry, I have to always clarify, because I know Australian dollars is different to like American dollars. So that's amazing.
Australian dollars. And so we've been able to do lots and lots of projects that otherwise may not have been possible. But what I'm doing right this minute, like today, is it's the end of the financial year here in Australia at the 30th of June. And so we always do a big end of financial year appeal, hoping that people will donate because it's tax deductible and they will get it back sooner rather than later. And so as part of an orangutan's rehabilitation process, once they have basically learned all the skills that they need to learn, so that they can be released back into the wild. It's all very well for them to have learned it by going out each day from their sleeping enclosure and spending the time in forest school and climbing the trees and knowing what food they need to eat. And most importantly, learning to build a nest and, all the skills that they need to be back in the wild on their own, what foods they need to eat. There's just so much involved. But it's all very well for us to have taught them all that. But if we were then to put them straight back out into the wild, we don't know how they would go. Like, because we haven't actually seen them living it on a daily basis, because they always go back at the end of the day because we have no other way of doing it, back to their sleeping enclosures. So, for example, in a sleeping enclosure, every single afternoon, the enrichment team take all the orangutans, lots of branches and things for them to put together. But really, then it's not up a tree. They're building their nests on the ground, of a sleeping enclosure, which, and it's very, very important that they have those leaves. But when they're in the wild, of course, orangutans can't sleep on the floor. It's way too dangerous. They need to be up those trees, building nests and sleeping up the tree. So one of the very, very important things they need to do before they're released is for our vets and our team to assess that they are actually really, really ready. And the best way to do that is to put them into what is called a haha. And a haha is actually an old English word, which means dry island moat. And what we do, when I say we, I'm talking about OFI, what they do is they will take a great big piece of pristine, proper orangutan rainforest, because OFI do own quite a bit of forest land. And then, whether it be a hectare or 2 hectares of land, they will then build a moat around it. When I say a moat, I mean there's a big trench dug, and then there's a concrete wall that comes out of it. But what that does is that allows an orangutan that's ready, hopefully, to be released back into the wild. And one of my dear favorite orangutans, Hayes, went into a haha today. So they go into the haha to be assessed. So they're in there. If it's a big cheek padded male, he can be the only male, always with a few females. If they're sub-adult males, then there can be one or two males put in the haha. And then the vets and everyone watches them to see how they're doing, and praying that they will, with time, build nests and start to sleep in the trees. It always takes a while because they're used to sleeping on the ground. But we've got the night vision binoculars we just bought, so now we can watch their behavior rather than with drones. And so once they're doing all the things that they would be doing in the wild, but within an enclosed kind of 2 hectares of rainforest. And also, of course, there's a feeding station, and so our carers are still taking in the food, the supplemental food that they would need. But then comes the day when they're doing everything right and they can be released back into the wild. So I'm sorry, that was a really long story about what a haha was.
It's
But
needed. No,
so
it's fine, fine.
they're crazy expensive to build. I mean, we already own the land, that's easy. And doing the moat part, like digging, we bring bobcats in and we dig the big trenches so that the orangutans can't escape. But what's super expensive is those walls need to be steel reinforced. And then, if you can imagine, the perimeter of 2 hectares, the amount of concrete, I mean, there's brick walls built, steel reinforced, and then the whole thing is very thickly concrete rendered, to be able to withstand the floods and the rain and, the wear and tear. And I don't know about in the UK, but in Australia, concrete is ridiculously expensive. And unfortunately, steel and concrete is expensive in Indonesia also. I mean, a lot of things are cheaper there, but that's not one of them. And we have to fly work teams over from Java. We have to hire all the equipment. We need the engineers. So to build a 1 hectare haha, Australian dollars, is about 100, right now with the currency conversion, is about $120,000 each. They're up to 200,000 for 2.5 hectares. So back to what I'm doing at the moment, I'm just writing the appeal because OFI Australia have now built 4 ha-has. The fourth one is just completed, and I've already got the money aside for the fifth. But we need to keep building ha-has because we have so many males in particular that need, desperately need, to be released into ha-has and get out into the wild. During COVID, fortunately, it was necessary, but the Indonesian government closed the national parks and they stopped us releasing. So we have, a backlog, if you like, of males that desperately need to get out. So we desperately need more ha-has, and so that's what I'm doing right now.
Fabulous. Keep it up. Yeah, the orangutans, rehabilitation process. It's longer than a sun bear cubs. I mean, if you're going to do it, it has to be done quick. It has to be done in the first couple of years normally. But with orangutans, yeah, it's a lot longer.
Yeah. Can I ask you, because I actually don't know, with a sun bear, because I know from you and from people at OFI that the sun bears, when they're rehabilitated, they do have to go back into the wild when they're young, because it doesn't work if they're adults. How is it up to 2 years old that you can release?
Well, generally the school of thought would be, yeah, you keep them in line with how it would be with their parent. They would normally stay with their mother for like the first couple of years and then go off and be independent. And so we found generally that it becomes too habituated and too used to people. So you do have to try and get them back out of the forest as soon as possible. I do know there are some orgs in like Malaysia, which they have a slightly different process where I think they release them maybe a little bit older. With the cubs, it's not like we just chuck them out by themselves, because it's such a long process, because someone has to go with them and stay with them and help them establish their territory, and then they'll get their own independence over time, which could take, some bears take longer than others, and obviously it has to be the right candidate. You don't just take anyone. You have to sort of, before we've taken them, you've satisfied all the criteria. Yes, they can do this. Yes, they can do this. They can climb up a tree, make a nest, because bears also make nests in trees, and they can forage, find up their own food. They can make it, basically.
Are females any different to... Sorry, I'm asking you questions.
I know, mate.
Are females any different to males? Are females less likely to be attacked by another sun bear, or makes no difference?
Well, if you'd asked me before, I would have said, I would have thought, yeah, females would be a bit more amenable, but we have had a female bear killed by another female over territory, we think. But females, I think, on the whole, have a better chance of survival than males. So if you're going to release a male, you have to make sure that there's no other sun bears in the area, because I think if there's a territorial dispute, that can either mean that bear will get killed, or it could get pushed out, and then, you know, it gets displaced, and then there's the fear that if it keeps getting displaced, eventually it's going to end up in human habitation as well. Yep.
Which can be dangerous.
Yeah, for all concerned. And it's also not good. It's also bad. It's bad PR for the wild population as well. So you're kind of not doing, sometimes you're a bit like, is releasing this bear the right thing to do for just the individual and also the population itself?
Thank you.
No problem. What would you like people to take away from just hearing about OFI Australia, OFI, sun bears, orangutans? I know you've touched on it already, but like, what is it about animals like orangutans that, why is it they touch people in such a way?
Oh, gosh. With why orangutans touch people, I honestly think, personally, that that people are drawn to orangutans because they're so human-like. I mean, they're our cousins. We're both great apes. And for me, what makes an orangutan just fascinating and extraordinary and so closely related to us is, yes, their DNA is very, very close to us. I think from memory it's 97.6 or something. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzees actually have a closer DNA to us as humans by a little bit. But where orangutans are just amazing is that their EQ, their emotional quotient, in other words, their feelings and their emotions are, I believe, the closest to us humans of any other animal. And I understand their EQ to be 98%, which means that when you're with an orangutan and you're watching an orangutan, their feelings and their emotions are just like ours. I have no idea what that extra 2% is that's different. But, you know, orangutans feel joy and happiness. I think they've got a sense of humour. They feel sadness. They feel jealousy, where sometimes they feel depression. They feel all the things that we do. I mean, can you imagine, you know, if we were to see our mother killed, I mean, how we would feel is exactly how they feel. So, you know, when you spend time with an orangutan, that eye contact, everything, you can relate to absolutely everything. Well, I feel that you can. So that makes them incredibly special. And just like us as humans, you know, we develop friendships with each other. And, you know, there'll be people that we walk past every day of our lives and we don't have a connection with. But, you know, then other people we become close friends with. And, I mean, I think that when you have a relationship with an orangutan, it's a one-on-one situation, and it's not human as opposed to orangutan. It's actually just a connection that you have. And so, you know, there's many orangutans at the care centre that I have never built a close relationship with because there are so many there, right? And I don't get to spend time with all of them. But then you also have orangutans that you built a really deep friendship with. And that's just super, super special. So, yeah, I think that orangutans are just incredibly, incredibly special, special creatures, and we need to save them. And what I would love for people to take away from listening to this is going to sound like me getting on a soapbox, but the reason that orangutans are critically endangered is because of deforestation of their habitat. And you know, Borneo used to be wall to wall jungle, but you know, there's almost nothing left. And in the last 20 years, I believe 90% of their forests, their habitat has been destroyed. And the majority of that has been destroyed for palm oil plantations. So, you know, us humans get on with our lives and we don't often think about what we're buying and what we're consuming and what's happening as a result of what we buy. But you know, when we walk into a supermarket, I would say 60 to 70% of everything in a supermarket contains palm oil. And we are buying all of that stuff. I'm not necessarily suggesting that people know and are doing it intentionally, but the fact of the matter is that we are buying it, which creates the demand, which creates, you know, the companies in Malaysia and Indonesia to need more palm oil plantations, which means they're going to take more rainforest away. And apart from the orangutans losing their habitat, and of course not just the orangutans but all the beautiful species that share that habitat, but on top of that, and I mean it was proven and discussed at length at the Glasgow climate change summits, that deforestation is the greatest cause of climate change for us humans. And living here in Australia and, you know, watching of course the natural disasters around the world, but here in particular in Australia, the fires, the wildfires that are happening and getting worse and worse and worse. It's getting hotter and hotter every summer. You know, the climate here is nothing like it was when I was younger. And it's the summers here are so intense now. So that's exactly what's happening also in Borneo. So on top of the deforestation, the orangutans are then dealing with the wildfires. So what I would like to ask everybody that cares about animals and wildlife is that, you know, when you're next shopping, please, it's not a hard thing to do. It sounds hard, but honestly, it's not. Please start being aware of what you're consuming. In Australia, we don't have mandatory oil labelling, but I know in the UK and in Europe there is. So when you look and you turn over the ingredients list in your supermarket, whether it be for ice cream, whether it's for snacks, for chips, for biscuits, it doesn't matter what it is, there is palm oil in just about everything. And if you turn over and look at the ingredients list with peanut butter, all kinds of things, if you see it says palm oil, or in Australia, if you're listening in Australia, if it says vegetable oil, then 99.999% of the time it is actually palm oil. Mm. The reason for this, it's the cheapest. And so those corporations make the most money. But the big losers are the orangutans and all those species that are sharing that habitat. So, you know, it doesn't have to be overwhelming. It doesn't have to be every single thing in your supermarket trolley, every single time. But if you just start with one or two or three items, let's start with peanut butter or biscuits, or, you know, it can be your shampoo and conditioner. Sodium lauryl sulfate is the name for palm oil or palm oil derivatives. In our cleaning products, in our skincare, things like toothpaste, shaving cream, anything that bubbles. So that's, you know, your hand washers and your dishwashing detergents and your laundry detergents all contain this thing called sodium lauryl sulfate. And it's the bubbling agent. It creates the bubbles and makes all things lather and lovely. Glycerin in skincare products that makes it soak in and makes your skin all lovely and soft. I mean, palm oil is this amazing, unfortunately amazing product that helps so many products to, you know, like chips, it makes them crispy, and biscuits, it makes them crunchy, and ice cream, it makes it creamy. I mean, it's annoyingly good product for these awful corporations making lots of money. That being said, there is an alternative for just about everything that has palm oil in it. So if you turn over your peanut butter and it says palm oil, please put it back on the shelf and then just pick up another one. And so many of them will just be peanuts, salt, and a little bit of sugar, and it's just ground peanuts. So, I mean, you can make a difference in an orangutan's life by choosing the right peanut butter, by finding palm oil-free products, and there's so many of them. So that's what I would love people to do, is to start helping us save orangutans. And the best way you can do that is with what you buy every day of your life in supermarkets and department stores. And then, of course, we're wanting to raise lots of money for bears. Maybe you can see your way clear to looking at our website, Orangutan Foundation International Australia. Please remember when you do a Google search to put the Australia in, and not just Orangutan Foundation, but Orangutan Foundation International, so you get the correct thing. We would love you to foster an orangutan and help their rehabilitation journey. We would love it if you were to donate or to buy merchandise. But the biggest thing you can do without, you know, going into your own pocket is to be aware of what you're buying and consuming and staying away from palm oil.
Definitely. Very eloquently put. It's funny. I am a habitual label reader these days, so I'm always trying to avoid palm oil. And I think I made a bit of a dark joke when I was at the sanctuary one of the times, and they had their coffee creamer and they were like, do you want some? And I was like, looking, I had palm oil, and I was like, oh, the ingredient should say orphaned orangutan.
Oh, yes, it should. And what do they say? No human treat should cause an orangutan to lose their home.
Oh, well, thank you, Kobe. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and be so open and honest. And I could listen to you all day. I'm sure I could definitely hear some more of your stories from your wayward youth.
They were fun, believe me. And honestly, thank you for inviting me, because I absolutely love talking to you, Philip, whether it's on here or off. And I've actually just got to thank you for all the help you give me, because, you know, it's an enormous amount that I ask you to do to help me. Your writing is
nothing,
just
it's nothing.
I'm so grateful. Thank you.
No, it's nothing, honestly.
And I'm so glad we got to talk about the bears.
Yeah, no, so am I. Thank you. I'm happy to talk about everything, but yeah, especially the bears, because they are sometimes kind of, you know, it's all about the orangutan sometimes. It's nice to remind people there are other animals such as the bears and whatnot there.
But yeah, thank you. And I love talking to you.
Listening. Oh, it's great.
I just don't shut up. I'm so sorry. I just talk.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Oh, I'm sure Kristen would be proud and overjoyed seeing what you've done.
I just take her with me. Every time I go to Borneo, I take her with me in my heart. And I know that, I mean, Kristen had the worst fear of missing out of anyone I've ever met in my life. She couldn't bear it. And so I just know that she couldn't bear to miss out on my trips. And so I'm sure she comes with me every single time.
Not bad. The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, was written and presented by me, Philip Stubley. The music was composed by React Music and Night Drift. Thank you to everyone who has helped make this podcast possible, including Karen Hauserman, Bill Lee, Clary Lee, Stephanie Horner, Donna Brazinka, Ross Coyer, and Angie Page. You can find out more about the American Bear Association at americanbear.org. You can find Vinshuti Wildlife Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. You can ask questions and submit comments about the podcast to pw@americanbear.org. The ABA is a special circumstance. We do not condone feeding wild animals. If you enjoy this podcast, help support the ABA, either by donating, becoming an ABA member, symbolically adopting a bear, or come visit the sanctuary during the season and say hello. And if you do enjoy this, please do us a favour. It'll barely take you a minute. On whatever platform you're listening to this on, please either follow us or click the bell for updates and notifications. Please share with family and friends and rate the podcast, as it all helps us grow and is greatly appreciated.